Tonight we're starting a series on the book of Esther. We're going to be taking a look at this book from a few different perspectives, not necessarily going chunk by chunk through the book, but we're going to take the first lesson and hit the major highlights of the book and continue through the rest of the series looking at it from different perspectives, through different lenses. I anticipate that this is going to be 4 or 5 lessons. And just to give you an idea of where we're going, tonight's lesson is Esther's personal growth. We're going to look at the major events that happen in the book, but specifically from the perspective of how Esther grows as a person. She transforms quite a bit as the book progresses, and that will be well worth our time to see. Then, the second one is providence in the book of Esther. Esther is a book that doesn't ever mention the name of God even once. It doesn't even always look like a very religious book to a lot of people. Yet there are a lot of God-shaped holes in this book that show that God is working in the background. We're going to take a look at some of the coincidental reverses that happen in the narrative. We'll look at how chapter 6 is a bizarre turning point that all points to God. The reason why I said the series is going to be 4 or 5 lessons is I think that one might take 2 lessons. We'll see how this goes. Next week is when we'll do that. Then third, living in a world ruled by sin. Esther and Mordecai are doing their best to live in a foreign, sinful land and remain pure. And they don't really do a very good job of that a lot of times. They're not perfect people. They're not exactly moral exemplars. So there are some lessons for us to learn, both positive and negative, from the choices they make as we find ourselves living in a sinful and hostile world. And then we'll conclude with allegories of Christ in Esther. This is another way that we see God within the book of Esther. There are many veiled references to the future Messiah all through this book. We're going to look at them as a series of allegories and see how the ultimate conclusion of the book of Esther is actually pretty empty unless there's a better fulfillment in Christ to come. Wanted to give you a heads up on where we're going with this. This will be over the next 4 or 5 Sunday evenings. I hope you'll be able to be here for the rest of the series. Let's jump into the narrative and look at Esther's growth. We need to start in chapter 1, verses 1 through 12, and see that King Ahasuerus is hosting an impressive banquet. Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. Now on the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the 3rd year of his reign he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. So Ahasuerus is hosting this impressive banquet for a very specific reason. He's planning to go to war against the Greeks. Now you think you're going to war, it's a strange time to throw a party. But actually, this was par for the course with Persia. The Persians had a tradition that when the leaders of state gathered to plan important matters and to discuss the affairs of the kingdom, it was what we would probably call today a raging party. They had a lot of alcohol, a lot of food. It flowed in great abundance. They actually considered that being inebriated brought you closer to the spiritual realm and helped you make good decisions, which probably tells you everything you need to know about the Persians. I've never met anyone who really thought alcohol made them, you know, make so much wiser decisions, but that's the way that they thought. And on top of that, Ahasuerus also has another purpose for this feast. He is trying to impress all of his people, all of the leaders of this nation, that they are ready for war. If he can show this 180-day-long banquet, that's 6 months, by the way, 6 months of this great planning session slash party, then he's showing, look how wealthy we are. Look, we have so much excess that even when we're going to war, we can throw this lavish party beforehand and still have plenty to spare. He's pumping up public opinion to be on his side so that everyone is excited for this war. It's got to be a sure thing because the king is this confident. In the course of this banquet, he commands Queen Vashti to make an appearance, and much ink has been spilled in trying to discuss this event and what exactly he is asking her to do and whether she should have refused him or not. And I'm partially going to sidestep that debate, although not really. The way I'm going to sidestep it is that it's not the point of the story. There's a reason why Vashti is discussed here. Whether she's right or wrong, it matters what the king thinks of her, and it sets the stage for why Esther is her replacement. Now, I will say that I'm inclined to believe that with a 6-month-long drunken party and a bunch of men doing what men do, this probably was fairly obscene and something that she probably needed to reject. That's the way that I do view this event. I think that's more logical. We can draw the parallels to what we talked about this morning with Herod having Salome come and dance before them. That's a little bit clearer than this is. But even still, either way, whether she should have rejected him or not, the important part is that for the purposes of this story, King Ahasuerus has been embarrassed. King Ahasuerus is trying to show the entire nation that he has everything in control, that he is powerful. He tells people what to do and they do it. They can go to war and they can be successful. And then his wife won't listen to him. His wife won't do what he says. And so what we see as the narrative goes on is that Queen Vashti is sent away. That probably means that she was demoted within the harem. It's possible she was sent away entirely, never to be around the king again, but probably just demoted from her position of highest in the harem, the one who gets to be wife and queen, to now a lower one in the harem who's there just for whatever the king may desire. And now King Ahasuerus needs a replacement. He needs a new concubine to be able to become his wife, to become the queen of the nation. And remember, this is all in the context of war, that this is a time that the kingdom needs to be strong and united and for everything to go smoothly. Esther would eventually be chosen as Vashti's replacement. And you need to understand why she's chosen. This is important. This is why Vashti was introduced. It's why this event of Vashti refusing the king is given to us. Not necessarily to give a specific moral lesson about that. I think there are just too few details to completely construct everything. But it sets the stage for why Esther is the perfect replacement for Vashti. Esther does not even start out as the main character of the book that's named after her. The whole first part of Esther is kind of weird. Read with me in chapter 2, verses 5 through 14. This is how long it takes, by the way, to actually get to an introduction of Esther, which is fine. We need some background information. But I want you to notice the way she's introduced and what she does, what she says, anything in here. Chapter 2, verses 5 through 14. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when a turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went in to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. That's how Esther is introduced to us. And maybe you're picking up on what I'm getting at here, in that she is perfectly passive throughout all of this. We learn nothing about anything Esther says or does, or any opinion that she has, or any functional part of her character. And connect this to Vashti. Vashti was beautiful, but in the king's eyes, too stubborn. In the king's eyes, she rejected him. She embarrassed him. She refused to do what he wanted her to do. So who's the perfect replacement for a queen like that? It's one who is also beautiful, but one who knows how to keep her mouth shut. And that's what Ahasuerus is looking for. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm saying it's what he's looking for. And that's exactly who Esther was here in the beginning of the book. She doesn't actually do anything. We don't know what she thinks about any of this. I don't know if she had much thought about any of this. She does everything she is told to do. She passively goes from place to place. She is perfectly obedient in every way. Everything that happens regarding Esther happens to Esther, not because of Esther. And so in verse 15, it says that Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. She was just passive enough to make everybody happy. So the story progresses with Esther mostly in the background. We learn that Mordecai has some official position in the king's court. It said that he was sitting at the king's gate. And if you're envisioning that he's like lounging there right by the gate, that's not what that was. The king's gate was a large building at the entrance to the citadel. And it was where a lot of official matters were taken care of. It was a government building. And that's where a lot of officials were. That's where you went for anything that had to do with most sections of the Persian government. And Mordecai is a government employee of some kind. We don't know exactly what his job was, but he worked there. So he's a Jew who's working for the Persian government. And in the course of his work there, he overhears a credible plan to assassinate the king. Two of the eunuchs who have a lot of access to the king are angry for some reason. And again, we're not told why. It's not really important for the story. But they want to kill him, and they have the means and the opportunity to do so. So Mordecai tells Esther about this, and Esther passes it on to the king, and the king's life is saved. The plot is foiled. In chapter 3, then, we start learning of Haman, who's promoted to grand vizier. He had second in command, just under the king, but over everyone else. And he immediately starts causing problems. He's angered that Mordecai won't bow to him because Haman is a very self-righteous and arrogant man. He has royal aspirations. He thinks he's a big shot, and he wants to be even more than he actually is. And when Mordecai won't bow to him, he's got to take care of Mordecai. But since he knows he's a Jew, he wants more than that. He wants to kill all of Mordecai's people as well. And he's able to get Ahasuerus on his side for this. He writes an edict and gets the king to authorize it that a day will be reserved for mass genocide of the Jews. And of course, Mordecai is deeply distressed by this decree. We're skimming through that pretty quickly. We're going to talk about it more in future lessons. But because Esther's pretty much in the background through this, it's not a whole big part of the scope we have for this lesson in particular. So don't worry, we'll hit it more in future lessons. We just need that summary to keep going. Finally, when we get to chapter 4, Esther starts doing something. She loses some of this passivity and timidity, and she begins acting in a productive way. She hears that Mordecai is mourning. And so she sends him clothes to replace his sackcloth. She tries to get him cheered up, but he won't be cheered up because his people are going to be killed. He is understandably upset. And so he passes along to Esther that she has a job to do. She has a duty to protect her people. Let's start reading in chapter 4, verses 8 through 17. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So Esther takes charge. She realizes that she does need to do something. She's convinced by Mordecai, so she resolves to act. This is an important turning point in her character. As we've noted, this is the first time in the whole book we see her really doing anything deliberate of her own accord. And you might be tempted to think that with the 3 days fast, that this is just a fast of mourning where she's taking 3 days to say, these are my last 3 days alive. I'm going to go before the king and probably be killed. And even if I do go before him and he doesn't kill me, he's not going to listen to me anyway. And I and all my people will die. But that's not what this fast is. They are mourning, but I believe there's quite a chance that they're praying as well. And not only are they mourning and praying, but Esther is planning. It's clear from what happens right after this that those 3 days are spent devising a plan that is somewhat complex, but does work the way that she intends it to. Let's look in chapter 5, verses 1 through 8. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther has prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." We had like the makings of a great plan, and then it looks like it's falling flat, but it's absolutely not. Esther has a very deliberate plan in action. When she goes before the king, that's a risky thing for her to do, right? He is just unstable enough that he has a rule that if you go before the king without an audience, then you are risking your actual life. Ahasuerus was not a very good king. We'll talk some more about that in a future lesson. But Esther does this anyway, and you would think that with the relief that he's finally going to listen to her, that she would blurt out her request and say, "Please save my people." But she doesn't. She says, "Will you and Haman come to a feast that I have prepared?" This is one of the reasons why I think we can know that those 3 days were spent preparing. The 3 days of fasting, because this feast is already prepared. She spent some time getting these things in order. She has this plan in the works. And so Haman and Ahasuerus and Esther are the three people at this dinner. This has a few different effects. One, we see that Esther is now dictating what's going on. Instead of being told where to go and what to do, as we've seen her doing the entire book, she's setting the schedule. And that's more important than it might look like. But she's doing it in a very smart way that is not going to make Ahasuerus feel threatened. Haman also gets to feel important. He gets to come to this feast. The only other people at this feast are the king and queen. That practically makes him royalty. That's so wonderful for Haman that it has his head swell to the size of a balloon, which is exactly what needs to happen here. And then Ahasuerus also gets the idea that Esther believes that Haman is important and that Haman needs to be here for this to happen. And we'll talk more about why that's important in a future lesson. It's going to help sow some of the seeds of Ahasuerus realizing that Haman is trouble without Esther outright saying it in the first place. So notice what King Ahasuerus says in chapter 2, verse 5. Or not chapter 2, verse 5. That would be chapter 5, verse 5. That he says, "Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked." Esther is setting the schedule here. This is important. So she gets them to the feast. Now this is the perfect opportunity, right? She can say what's on her mind. She has the king there. She has Haman there. It can all be resolved. But instead she does something strange. Ahasuerus says, ask me what you will and I'll give it to you, even to half the kingdom. And she says, come to another feast tomorrow that I will prepare. Some people think here that Esther was feeling scared, that she couldn't muster up the courage to say what she had to say. I don't believe that for an instant. Even though it wouldn't be that hard to believe that in Esther's character early in the book, there is a specific reason why she's stretching it out like this. In the high school class this morning, we were talking about, we were studying from Philemon, and one of the things that Aaron was bringing up was that Paul is writing to Philemon in a way that is expecting Philemon to do the right thing and in a sense buttering him up, but not in the negative way that we often imagine that to be. We sometimes associate that with manipulation, with schemes, with dishonesty, and it certainly can be that way. But there are times when we just know that it matters how we frame something, that it matters setting the stage properly and making sure that someone is in the best position possible to receive what we are about to say. That is tact. That is wisdom. That is understanding an appropriate and effective plan to maximize your chances for success. And leadership needs that. Leadership needs to frame things in the best way possible if you want the most success possible. And that's exactly what Esther is doing here. The king is somewhat unstable. He is not a very effective leader. He causes all sorts of problems. So Esther is making sure that he's in the best mood possible. We have these feasts for him to enjoy. She's piquing his interest because he knows this is something important or she wouldn't have come before him unbidden. And then she extends that curiosity by saying, come to this feast. And then she extends it a little bit more. Come to the feast the next day. He's basically sitting on the edge of his seat saying, just tell me what it is. I want to do it for you. I want to do whatever you ask. Esther has him in the best possible position without being dishonest, without being manipulative, just by being smart. That's what she's doing. And notice the way that she frames it when she says, let me find it again in verse 8. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, come to the feast that I will prepare for you tomorrow. The way she words it is, if you will do what I ask, then come to this second feast where I'll tell you what it is that I'm asking. And that's not her trying to trap him in some legal loophole or anything. It's that she's getting him basically to say, I really want to do what you are asking for. And that does matter. It matters to get him emotionally on board with this before he even knows what the request is. So then we get to the second feast, and it's there in perfect timing. Esther chapter 7, verses 3 through 6. We're skipping over the most important chapter in the entire book, by the way. That's chapter 6. Come back next week for that. Chapter 6 is the most important one, and we will spend zero time there today, but we're looking at what Esther is doing specifically. Chapter 7, verses 3 through 6. They're at this feast. Haman has been rushed over there. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with a loss to the king. And then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he, who has dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. that Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Esther drops the bombshell at the perfect time and tells the king, Haman is trying to kill my people. Ahasuerus is angry. He gets up and storms off, maybe to try to cool down, maybe to figure out just exactly what he's going to do to Haman. And Haman is terrified. I want you to notice something special here. Haman is terrified not just of Ahasuerus, he's terrified of Esther too. Do you think anybody would have been terrified of the Esther at the beginning of the book? Esther's grown here. She's grown enough to do something that is effective, that can correctly expose the evil that Haman is trying to plot, and Haman rightly recognizes that Esther is a threat. Esther is no passive wallflower anymore. She is a force to be reckoned with. And so Haman tries to beg Esther for mercy. While Ahasuerus is out of the room, he falls before her and he says, spare my life. Don't let him kill me. Don't kill me yourself. But Ahasuerus has him killed and has him hanged from the stake that Haman had intended to use for Mordecai. As we get to the end of the book, we see Esther coming fully into her own, to be fully empowered as a queen with royal authority. In chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, on that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So the king gives Esther wealth and power. Instead of just being the best of the concubines, now she's a queen with some real power for her own. She has the power to basically do what she wants. She has all the riches of the house of Haman. She influences him to promote Mordecai to Haman's old position. So whereas Mordecai was once the one who was raising Esther and helping Esther and convincing her to do the right thing, now she's the one who is lifting him up to a position of greater authority than he was in before. And so she and Mordecai are given the authority to write whatever decree they want to defend the Jews from the imminent genocide that had already been decreed. Remember that this day had been established, that it would be fully legal and encouraged to kill any Jew you would find, and there were lots of enemies of the Jews. And so Esther and Mordecai write this decree and have it sealed with the signet ring of a king, to be authorized by the king, that the Jews could defend themselves and that the Jews could fight back. And so they successfully do that on that day, and then Esther even petitions the king for there to be a day of vengeance given, that the Jews are able to launch a counterattack against the people who tried to kill them. And they do, and the Jews have a great victory. Then finally we see that she and Mordecai command that Purim should be observed every year as a remembrance of these events. Purim is a two-day long, for each of the days of those decrees, a two-day long festival remembering what happened on that terrible day. And that feast, that festival, is still observed by the Jews to this day. So I want to close by establishing two different things. I won't go there yet. Two different things. One, this lesson is laying a lot of groundwork for some more specific applications that we're going to make in lessons to come. I know there's some things that we skipped over. I know there are some parts of the book that we went over very quickly, some characters that didn't get very much mentioned because we're focusing just on Esther, really, today. Do not fear. Next week, we're going to talk about some more of those people. And as the series progresses, we will make more specific applications about this book. But there is still something important we can get from the part we looked at tonight. Esther started out as this timid and weak and entirely passive young woman who is appreciated only for being beautiful and being quiet. And she grew. She changed. Now, quiet can be good. Discretion can be good. But not to the point of total passivity. Not to the point of refusing to act when something needs to happen. And Esther was able to grow and to become the kind of woman who could save her people from genocide. She had to be pushed into it a little bit, but she came into her own. If the young Esther at the beginning of the book could have looked into the future and seen the Esther that was handing down royal decrees, that was devising plans to stop Haman, that was instituting a festival that would be observed for hundreds and for thousands of years to come, would she have believed what she even saw? I don't know. I don't think she would have recognized that woman looking into the future. Take that as a message of encouragement for us. We sometimes think that we are entirely static. I am who I am, and this is all that I'll ever be. I can grow. I can change. I can be more tomorrow than I am today. No matter where I am today, with a little push to do the right thing, with some work, with some effort, I can become much more than I started out at. That's true for all of us. Maybe your problem isn't that timidity like Esther has, or maybe it is. Regardless, you can grow. You can overcome your weaknesses with God's help, with prayer, with study, with work, with encouragement from the people around you. You can become more tomorrow than you are today. That's where we're going to leave it tonight. There are some God-shaped holes in the narrative that we'll pick up at next week and see how even this book that has no explicit mention of God really has God on every page. And I hope you'll be back for that. But tonight, if there's anything we can do for you, if you're ready to become a Christian and to grow in your spiritual journey, to start serving God, then we're happy to help you with that. And we're happy to help you with that not just tonight, but we're happy to continue helping you on your journey all the way through. We're all on a journey. None of us have it all figured out. None of us are perfected. We're all becoming more each and every day. And so if there's anything we can do for you, please come forward as we stand and sing.